Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Conduct Detrimental, the only sports law podcast, or any podcast for that matter, that's being broadcast live from Siberia and Fifth Avenue in New York City. I'm Daniel Wallach, the co-host of Conduct Detrimental. Joining me, as always, is Daniel Lusk, my co-host from the prestigious law firm of Garagos & Garagos. How are you doing, Dan?
I'm good, Dan. I think we're still riding high from our last episode with Brian Windhorst. So I know you and I were talking offline. This is trending to be one of our most popular episodes of all time. If you haven't listened to it, obviously just the last one, I would check it out. But Dan, I don't know if you know this, but we are starting to develop an international audience for this podcast. I'm going to break you down some numbers. Ready? Our last episode with Brian Windhorst was downloaded among other countries: Germany, France, the Philippines, the UK, Ireland, Saudi Arabia, Belgium, Austria. We're hitting a lot of countries, and not to mention, obviously, Mexico and Canada. But Dan, I do want to tell you, I can't think this is a coincidence. We're starting to get an uptick in our Russian listenership. Are you spreading the gospel to your neighbors over there in Siberia?
Yeah, I think my in-laws are checking out Conduct Detrimental. So you may have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm trying to figure out how many I've got. I've got 5 in-laws living in Siberia, plus me, plus my wife. So I don't know. I don't know if they've been listening, but I mean, it just goes to show you that sports law is global. You know, sometimes we cover stories involving Lionel Messi and major stories involving Olympic athletes around the world. So it's not surprising that we may attract listeners from different segments of the world. But so far, I don't think we have anybody from Kazakhstan. So that gives us something to shoot for going forward. But it's always exciting to learn of people's interest from countries that you wouldn't even think would have an interest in the issues in U.S. sports law. But you never know. Maybe they're just attracted to you, Dan, or no?
I mean, maybe they're attracted to what I have to say, Dan, but this is a podcast. They don't know what I look like. Listen, no one's looking at Zoom. But Dan,
you have to admit our podcast, you know, branding and the cover of how we appear on Apple. Maybe it attracts some of the listeners overseas. But we are building an audience, and it's exciting. And I think one of the reasons we have been increasingly successful is not only are we consistent in how we deliver some of the broadcasts, but we're growing our team. You know, why don't you tell us how Conduct Detrimental has kind of transcended the podcast universe and is entering the domain of TikTok, and tell everybody a little bit about our team and then break it down for what we're going to be doing today.
So I will get to the business, but I have a funny story for you, Dan. Are you ready for this? Mm-hmm. So I have friends that listen to the podcast. They listen to episodes when I give them potential topics. So a lot of our friends were interested in Top Shot, my friends. So I told them Ryan Windhorst broke down Top Shot. So I got and you can kind of see it in the numbers, a lot of new listeners to Conduct Detrimental. But I do want to say, Dan, I know last time we took a portion of the podcast at the beginning to actually explain to people that you were physically in Siberia, that this was not a running gag. So a lot of my friends popped out of the woodwork and said, I thought this whole Siberia thing was actually just a joke. But Dan, can we confirm once again, this is not a joke, that you're literally in Siberia? We're on a 12-hour time difference. You're under oath here, counselor.
Yeah, despite for those of you watching on YouTube, you're seeing Madison Square Garden as my backdrop. I couldn't be any further away from Madison Square Garden than where I am right now. I have been in Siberia, in the capital city of Siberia, Novosibirsk, since December 29th. My wife is originally from Novosibirsk, and we're visiting her family. And a one month trip has kind of turned into two and a half months, and we're kind of enjoying it here. And it's really a nice little angle to pursue that, this American, sports betting attorney is practicing law while he's in Siberia. So it's a good backstory for the podcast. And I don't know how much longer this is going to last, but I truly am in Siberia. And not for the first time. This is my second trip, and I'm about to enter in another couple of days. I'm about to enter the third month of being in Siberia. And I got to tell you, the people have been so friendly. More people speak English in this remote part of the world than you would have any reason to expect. They're super friendly. And you know, I've been surprised by how easy the transition has been going from Florida to Novosibirsk, Siberia. If anything, the internet service has been a lot better, and the Russian food, of course, dramatically better. So I'll ride this out for another few weeks.
You're very complimentary of Russia, and I don't blame you. But I guess this will—they're
listening. They're listening.
Into our topics of the week. So for those that follow Dan and I on social media, I was having fun. We had a story that we had some developments in the National Hockey League that were breaking at 3 p.m. We'll say normal time, Eastern Standard Time, which was 3 a.m. Dan time. So, you know, Dan might have been asleep and fairly because Dan has to sleep at some point. But we have an update on I think the story is perfectly in your wheelhouse. It's a Russian NHL New York Rangers story. That's the Artemi Panarin. Am I saying this right, Dan, Mr. Hockey Expert?
Obviously, you're obviously not a hockey fanatic. It is. You got it right. It's Artemi Panarin. It's a power play goal to imitate Sam Rosen. But this is the perfect story that transcends U.S. Russia relations, NHL, KHL, my favorite hockey team, along with the whole dynamic between Putin and Navalny. It's sort of the sports law story of our time.
It's in the history of sports law stories, if you are Dan Wallach. Can we agree on that, Counselor?
Yeah, to say that this is in my wheelhouse is an understatement. And I've been doing my best to try to stay neutral about this. And I'm looking at this is a sports law podcast. I don't want to cover the entirety of the story, but essentially, Artemi Panarin is a star player for the New York Rangers. He's their first line left wing. In Artemi Panarin's case, it's an accusation by his former coach in the KHL from over 10 years ago. He played in the KHL as an 18, 19-year-old kid. And Panarin is known, besides being known as a superstar on the Rangers, he is one of the most vocal critics among Russian athletes of the policies in Russia, and he's made a number of statements that have been very supportive of Navalny and critical of the Putin regime. So he's basically putting a big bullseye on his back in Russia, and a former coach of his has now accused him of assaulting an 18-year-old girl in Latvia a decade ago when he was playing for the KHL.
Let's Dan, you're so excited.
Want to dive in deeper than that?
You're so excited to talk about it. I just want to give people the topics we're going to talk about, and then I'm going to give it to you.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's almost like we haven't done this podcast 100 times before.
You led me down the wrong path.
I don't know if I led you down the path. You're ready to dive down the path. Okay, just briefly, right. Dan gave you the teaser. We're going to talk about the bread man, as I've been told. Artemi Panarin. Then we're going to talk about the developments that we had in the college sports name, image, and likeness realm. The biggest update this week is with Notre Dame opting out of EA Sports. We're going to talk about that. I'm joining friend of the show, Chris Gabriel, ESPN Fresno, to explain that development later today. So I should have a replay posted on my feed if you missed that. Then we're going to talk about a situation that has since kind of resolved itself. That's the Kevin Mathur situation with the Seattle Mariners. Made some comments talking about an old topic of ours, service time manipulation. It's a larger issue in baseball on a number of levels, but so we'll get into that. And then fourth, we'll say it's 4A and 4B. We're going to talk about two NFL topics, the Xavier Howard situation, also involving friend of the show, Darren Heitner. It's a cornerback over with the Miami Dolphins. A since resolved criminal case, but with cases that are, we'll say, in the South, Florida, Georgia, you never know when those cases are actually done, as we saw with the DeAndre Baker situation. And last but not least, Dan and I are going to touch on the Deshaun Watson situation as one to monitor. So, Dan, with that being said, now I'm going to give you the floor. The floor is yours. The ice is yours. Fill us in on the Panarin situation and everything you're hearing from your sources on the ground and on the ice in Novosibirsk, Russia.
Yeah, well, I got to be careful how deeply I delve into this story because, as I mentioned to you off air, I'm not sure if my laptop is being eavesdropped on by Russian authorities, because I could tell you that when I first got to Russia and began working from home, everything was normal. I had normal internet speed. I was able to access every website. But given the nature of my business, I do a lot of work in the field of sports gambling and gambling law generally. And I visit a lot of gambling sites, research, news articles, everything is gambling. So I'm noticing that over the past couple of weeks, my internet access has changed dramatically for the worse, slower speed. I'm being blocked from a number of websites. So as sort of a caution or sort of a, just a little cautionary warning before I delve into Artemi Panarin, they might be listening to us. So with that admonition out of the way, here's what we know. Okay. Unless you haven't picked up a, newspaper or been following the news in the last 2 days, the New York Rangers star left winger Artemi Panarin, who's a very public critic of the Putin regime, and he's supportive of Navalny and so many of his public comments, is facing this really just crazy allegation that he assaulted a woman in Latvia 10 years ago, when he was an 18, 19 year old player playing in the KHL for his ex-coach Andrei Nazarov. Well, Nazarov is known to be a supporter, a very vocal supporter of the Putin regime, and has in the past couple of days lodged this allegation or accusation against Artemi Panarin. And what's really unusual about this is this is not the victim of the crime coming forward 10 years later. There are no known witnesses. There are no police reports. There are no incident reports. There is absolutely nothing that would even remotely constitute evidence, except for this ex-coach's recollection or belief that Artemi Panarin assaulted a woman and that the team had to pay off the Latvian authorities in euros at a time when Latvia was not part of the European Union and euros weren't even the currency. So this allegation being made against Panarin from Russia involving events that took place entirely in Russia, if at all, have led Panarin to request a 2-week or request a leave of absence from the New York Rangers. And that request for leave has been granted. And we don't know how long Panarin is going to remain, away from the team, but presumably he's fearful of reprisals potentially against him or his family members that are living in Russia. So I would expect this absence from the Rangers to be measured in weeks, not days. And, Dan, this is one of the craziest things that I've ever heard involving a player in the National Hockey League, because it has dimensions pertaining to Russia-U.S. relations, Putin, Navalny, events taking place entirely overseas that have caused repercussions within the National Hockey League. So I don't know where this is going to go, but I think, from a disciplinary standpoint, we don't know enough about the situation yet to size up what the impact is going to be for Panarin with regard to his playing status, because from all indications, this story and at least these accusations, at least at this point, aren't backed up by the kind of evidence that would make one worry about whether Panarin will face any consequences or discipline.
So the story is a little alarming. I've been told through my hockey friends that Panarin is not just a Ranger, that he's one of the top talents in all the NHL. So, if there is an equivalent to this in sports, if anybody wants to draw some type of parallels, it's probably Enes Kanter's situation. I'm going to mess up the pronunciation, but I think it's pronounced Erdogan, the Turkish president. So, Kanter, he puts up numbers, but my hockey sources have told me that Panarin is at a different level of superstardom than Kanter. He's at a higher tier of overall talent. So if you're in hockey circles, this story is front page news, whereas with Kanter, played for the Knicks. I think Kanter's a character. But this, we have had something like this similar happen. So Kanter's story similar to Panarin, he spoke out about, against the, we'll say, leadership of the incumbents. He spoke in favor of the opposition. And Cantor, basically, I've listened to podcasts with Cantor, he's scared to leave the country. But to Cantor's credit, and different, and not to say one is right as one is wrong, Cantor has been pretty, we'll say, brazen with his continued criticism of the government. And he's pretty open about it. I mean, he's scared, and he's scared to go on international trips, but he's continued to play. So that's the one thing that I thought was just interesting to point out. Cantor never stopped playing, right? And we never had an allegation that popped up against Cantor in Turkey for doing any type of assault or anything like that. So again, we're not, this isn't a court of law, but just to draw parallels with the Turkish situation and the Russian situation, something's coming up from 2011, and now Panarin has kind of dropped out. Well, you know, he's not making any type of comments. He's dropped off. Do you think, Dan, and I'm just pointing out just two differences. Do you think there's anything we should or could read into the fact that he has now gone media silent with respect to those old allegations?
I mean, I don't expect Panarin to be giving press conferences on a daily basis. I think his agent has spoken for him and the team has spoken for him. And, you know, these comments attributed to Panarin and Panarin's agents are all within the last 24 to 48 hours from when we're reporting this, recording this podcast. So I don't expect daily updates. The situation between Cantor, Enes Cantor, and Panarin are different in that I think Cantor was actually sideways with the Turkish government. There were repercussions being threatened by the government against Cantor.
And his family as well, I should mention.
Yeah, I don't see any indication that the Russian government is even at all involved in this. And from what I've gathered about Andrei Nazarov, he may be acting in a rogue capacity here because he's not currently employed as a KHL coach, and he may be doing this simply to curry favor with with some of the forces that are loyal to Vladimir Putin. We have no idea, but there's no indication that there's any state sanctioning behind this. Okay, we've seen zero. The story that was reported in Russia, I don't think it was picked up by the major news publications. It wasn't on the news shows that I watch at home in Siberia, where I'm living with my wife. It just seems to lack the state sponsorship that has driven so much of the fear that surrounds Enes Kanter's case. So I think it remains to be seen whether Panarin has any kind of a concern, a legitimate concern about repercussions against him. I just think that this is an ex-coach that has an ex to grind with him that may be talking out of school a little bit. I would expect Panarin to eventually come back to active duty for the New York Rangers within the next couple of weeks. He's being paid. And right now he's in the United States. He's not under any reasonable fear of repercussions directed towards him personally, but to the extent he has family members and is concerned about them, I think the Rangers have given him a lot of room here to get his affairs in order and to make sure that people close to him are safe. Because let's face it, he's their best player. He's a Hart Trophy finalist from last year. He is one of the most popular players in the league, and he's absolutely beloved in that room. So given the goodwill that he's generated with the team, they're obviously going to be supportive of him, not just to a point, but almost above and beyond. And I would expect him to come back soon. But I don't think this investigation or this story is going to go anywhere if you don't have a complainant, mm-hmm. meaning a victim, if you don't have corroborating, if you don't have any direct eyewitness testimony. This is not like any of the Me Too cases where right. at least you have a witness accusation. You have a woman or a man, in the case of Kevin Spacey, you have a person who's going up on the line, identifying themselves and saying, I was assaulted. Maybe that may not be backed up by a lot of evidence, but at least you have a person willing to go on the record, identifying themselves and accusing the person of a crime. We're lacking that here. And I'm not saying that that's impossible, that no crime occurred, but if certainly there is any meat on that bone, if there's any legitimacy to these accusations, if we're to believe that they're plausible, somebody else would need to step forward, an ex-teammate, the victim, some type of incident report translated from Russian, some official who would testify that he received a bribe or that he did the police write-up. There are so many independent or third parties that can be used to at least lend some credence to the story that until that happens, I think public sentiment and I think the prevailing view within at least, you know, the American media and NHL circles is largely going to be pro Panarin, because this all took place in Russia when he was a kid. And in the absence of any evidence, all we have is an ex-coach's allegation, an ex-coach with an axe to grind.
So a couple things. And, you know, in addition to watching sports and all things law, I tend to divulge in Bachelor Nation. That might surprise some people. It was a controversy we had about 2 weeks ago, probably at this point. But Dan, if I say who Chris Harrison is, do you know who that is? If I said Chris Harrison?
No, I don't.
Your position is Artemi Panarin and mine is Christopher Harrison. So there was just to point out, like, this is a 2011 allegation, but by no means, right, if there is some truth to this, it doesn't absolve him of guilt or culpability if he did it when he was a kid. So Chris Harrison made some, anyone that follows Bachelor, he made some comments that, you know, some racially charged pictures or parties that someone was at, it was okay. You know, it was based on the time. So, like, that's, I guess we should just point this out as an overall, like, we are by no means condoning any type of assault at any type of age. But, you know, as lawyers, we can only work with the evidence that we have. So if there's no victim and the only proof of this thing having occurred is someone that's saying, you know, someone that's a third party is saying, hey, I remember this happening, but you can't provide, at least as far as we're aware, sufficient details about time, date, location, names, witnesses. That's the type of stuff that as lawyers, right, as a DA, you're going to view this with some shred of you know, being not credible. So, you know, when Dan, you and I spent a lot of time talking about the Dan Snyder situation, right? We have names now and victims that are coming forward. Antonio Brown, names and victims coming forward. That's still what we don't have in this situation. So I guess, you know, not that Dan and I are picking sides, but like on an unbiased sense, right? We just don't have the evidence to take this to a point where we can really believe these kind of baseless allegations. If they're true, obviously he could take a step. And Dan, here's my only thing for you, as someone, you know my background in public relations. This is by no means any type of guilt on Panarin, but you're very confident that he's going to come back in a matter of days, right?
Weeks. You don't take a leave of absence for a few days.
But what's the strategy? Why take him out, right? He has nothing. If he didn't do anything wrong, which I don't have any reason to think he did, why is he being pulled out of the lineup? I don't understand that part.
Because it's very rattling to an individual who now might be fearing reprisals against him and our family members from a world superpower.
But what changes in days and weeks? Like, the story's not going to go away.
I don't think it's going to be days. I think in a matter of weeks, for example, the coach's allegations could be recanted. Nobody else coming forward. It could be some, you know, further clarity brought to the issue. And I think Artemi Panarin, and I don't have a window into what his thought process is at this point, but I think his first priority is the safety of his parents, the safety of his grandmother and grandfather and any other relatives that he has in Russia. So his focus right now is distracted, understandably, by these accusations, serious accusations that he committed a criminal act in his home country of Russia that could be sort of a repercussion or a reprisal for political statements that he's made. This is really serious, a really serious thing that's hanging over his head that understandably distracts him from his day-to-day obligations and playing hockey for the Rangers. I don't think this goes away in a few days, but I think maybe in a couple of weeks he'll be in a position to return to the New York Rangers unless something else breaks surrounding the story. And the Rangers are giving him that kind of room. But at this point, there's just simply nothing for the NHL to investigate.
So I'm not a devil's advocate, but I'm just going to give you a scenario where, because it doesn't, I know everyone's saying, you know, and I've seen it elsewhere, he's going to be back in a couple of weeks, but I don't really know what changes between today and a couple of weeks with the story. The story's still going to be there. But I know people hire attorneys for this, investigate, and personal investigators for this. What could be happening, again, this is just a hypothetical, but would make sense, is if he would hire someone, right, like maybe, you know, when we're in our, you know, teenage years or early 20s, however old he was back then, we don't know the people we associated with, you know, so maybe he's hiring someone to go and do some recon and figure out if there is truth to it, if there's a victim behind the scenes, and maybe they're trying to do some recon work before they speak further on it. That's what would make sense if they're buying some time to try to figure out if there's any grains of truth to it. You know, and maybe the Rangers, because I think they released a joint statement, so maybe they're working together, but for protecting the asset and making sure he doesn't put his foot in his mouth, like some people tend to do when they make statements like this, I think it's a smart decision on this end. Let's not make statements, and let's not, as the Rangers, put our star asset out there until we fully know the truth of the situation. So if I was the Rangers general counsel, I would probably be hiring someone in Russia on the ground, maybe a sports betting lawyer with the person who can, potentially to figure out the truth of the story. But yeah, I mean, jokes aside, I think that's probably what they're doing. They're probably hiring people on the ground to figure out the truth of this, and then they'll take it from there.
Yeah, this goes to the very top of the U.S. and Russia. You're talking about a political opponent who was, you know, poisoned, and this is more than just having an opinion about a political issue. This is really a serious matter. That would be deeply concerning to Panarin, and he'd be naturally worried about, you know, members of his family. So I think he just wants to get everything in order and clear his head and, consult with either lawyers or crisis professionals or, you know, some people in Russia. And I think his focus is going to be on this issue for the next couple of weeks. And he's not in any frame of mind, I would think, to be playing hockey for the New York Rangers right now. So this is a story that we're going to keep following because of all the, you know, really interesting elements to it that transcends so many different areas. I think we're just at we're not even at chapter one. This is just an accusation, and we'll learn a lot more about this and whether there are really any reprisals going on, or we'll learn more about whether there's anything of substance to this accusation. And we're only one or two days into it.
Okay, so that will we'll close it. At least that chapter on Panarin for now. The second topic I wanted to make sure we carve some time out for. Dan and I have said many times, and it's not a secret to anybody, the year of 2021 is still setting up to be, the biggest year in terms of NCAA NIL, changing kind of the landscape of paying college athletes. But there's a number of issues on the legislative level, on a Supreme Court level, and you can drop in my DMs, as somebody did recently, to ask me what are the best episodes to re-listen to if they're trying to get a feel for the college sports realm. But we're just going to assume that people are following us as we're into this episode. But the update, we talked about it a couple episodes ago. So big news, probably 2 weeks ago at this point, EA Sports announced that they were bringing back college football, their video game. The game had used to be called NCAA Football 2014, and then there was a year's worth of hiatus. I want to say 6-7 years, and that was because of the Ed O'Bannon lawsuit, which basically said that college players, right? And I'm just going to brief synopsis. If you have QB number 10 and they're playing for Ole Miss, and the guy looks a lot like Eli Manning and has Eli Manning's attributes and all that stuff, you kind of have to pay Eli Manning for that. You have to kind of pay Johnny Manziel, Jameis Winston, anybody who fits the criterion, and you're using their likeness. So the game disappeared, and we've known for a while the game could come back, but in order for the game to come back, as we know it, you have to pay the players because you're using their name, image, and likeness. So we had a big announcement that college sports were coming back to video games, but with the caveat that we would have the schools we know and love, the stadiums we know and love, jerseys we know and love, the logos we know and love, but we'd have generic players. And I'm not sure how a game like that would do on the open market, because it's not what we've purchased over the years. But, you know, we've talked about in the past podcasts, you can edit and customize the rosters to resemble something on your own, but that's usually doing it. It's not EA Sports doing it on their own. So in that scenario, when you have a game with generic players, there is no need to compensate the players for that type of game. So it's a slippery slope. We got the game that we love back, but the players aren't being compensated for it. That's what's setting up. This game is going to come out sometime in 2023. So that was the landscape that we knew, and there was going to be a question as to whether consumers were comfortable paying schools for the game, but not giving players any piece of this. So without name, image, and likeness being confirmed, players aren't going to get paid for it. So, that's the world. So we had an update this week. And Dan, I'd love to hear, you know, if you think that we're going to hear the last of this. Dan shaking your head, but I'll get some good answer out of you. But Notre Dame, the Fighting Irish, one of the most popular schools in the entire country, basically said, listen, other schools, if they're cool taking money and making a college football game and not using players' names and likeness, that's fine. We're not going to do that because it sends a really bad message. I'm paraphrasing, but it sends a bad message that players are going to profit. Players are not going to profit, but we as the school are. So, you know, Dan, I know this is not necessarily your comfort zone, but let me ask you, as a, you know, we'll take you back to 30-year-old or 20-year-old Dan Wall, 20-year-old Dan Wall. If one school, if Notre Dame is not in the game, do you think people are going to not buy this game?
No, not unless we're in 1971 when Notre Dame, you know, the last time, it's not the last time Notre Dame mattered, but the Notre Dame brand isn't what it was in the 1970s and 1980s, where along with Alabama, University of Texas, you're talking about one of the perennial superpowers in college football. Now, Notre Dame is still a major program, but, you know, it is one of many. And I wouldn't suspect that a game that doesn't include Notre Dame would have a real issue. Maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I'd give a different answer, but I don't think it really matters.
So I'm gonna agree with you. I don't think it matters if 1970 or 2021. I don't think it matters at all. I think people are gonna buy a game because they love college football. Even Notre Dame fans, because Dan is, people will know that are in the video game space, they'll probably, the game will probably create a team that's called like the South Bend Shamrocks. And then people will just go to edit team name and they'll change it to Notre Dame and they'll change it to Fighting Irish and they'll make whatever customizations they need to. And EA Sports will wipe their hands with it and say, well, we didn't do that. We're not benefiting off name, you know, the school's name. The users can customize and all that fun stuff. So it's a really slippery slope. I think the only way it hurts the sale of games, truthfully, is if the whole game, if all teams opt out and they make some stand against EA Sports. But like college sports is a business. I can't see all teams opting out, but I can see conferences trying to make a statement. Just like, you know, the Big Ten tried to do once upon a time when they opted out of college football. They're like, we care about player safety first and foremost. We don't care about the profit. And if it wouldn't shock me if a conference as an entity basically said, we don't want our schools involved. We care about paying players first and foremost. And that might send a very big message to recruits to say, like, listen, we're not all about getting paid. We care about paying you guys as a player. So it wouldn't shock me if a conference took that route, but just Notre Dame is not going to do anything. But I think it would be shocking if no other schools followed Notre Dame's lead. So something to watch for. I think it's just another, I mentioned it, just another one of these decision points that's going to put a little bit more pressure on NCAA to figure out name and likeness. You have a powerful school like Notre Dame saying, opting out. This is money that are out of schools' pockets. So by all means, I think it's going to increase the time frame. And obviously, Dan, the date to keep paying attention to is that March 31st oral argument date in the Alston versus NCAA case. That's at the United States Supreme Court. So a couple ticking time bombs on the NCAA front. Dan, anything else to add before we move on to our next topic?
No, I think that about covers it.
That said, let us move on to topic number three. I'm going to let you, because you did such a good job with our canary situation. Can you explain what's going on with the former Seattle Mariners executive, Kevin Mather?
Yeah, I mean, I think it underscores that Major League Baseball teams have very lax hiring standards and background check standards, because now this is, I mean, how many times have we gone through this? We've had, executives with the Houston Astros, New York Mets, now the Seattle Mariners. It just seems as if, there's one black eye after another with some of these Major League Baseball, you know, team presidents, team executives. This guy, Kevin Mather, is like probably an example, another example of a Zoom call gone awry, gone wrong. I mean, 2 weeks ago, we were talking about the cat lawyer. Well, this was a Zoom call where the CEO of the Seattle Mariners made a number of just horrific statements about Latin America, Spanish speaking players, the team finances, and I wouldn't say most troublingly, but he exposed what was already known by so many of us that follow, you know, baseball, the teams manipulate the service time of these up and coming players to keep them basically under team control for at least one more year. We saw that exposed in the Chris, it wasn't exposed, but we saw that, I think, most vividly in the Chris Bryant case involving the Chicago Cubs. You know, he comes up in 2015 and he's this, you know, number one overall pick from a few years before. He hits 9 home runs in spring training, bats over 400, and the team sends him down to the minor leagues and then brings him, calls him back up 12 minor league games later in order to keep him under team control for one more year. Well, on this Zoom call, Kevin Mather talked about another up-and-coming player that will soon be a household name in Major League Baseball, and that's Jared Kelenic. I don't know if I'm pronouncing Gerard or Jared correctly, but his last name is spelled Kelenic. And Kelenic is one of the embarrassing episodes of the New York Mets, you know, recent unfortunate trading history. The Mets traded him 2 years ago in the Robinson Cano deal, and his star has just risen, you know, dramatically in the last 2 years, so much so that he's thought to be a 5-tool player, a potential future major league superstar. And the Mariners offered him a 6-year contract before he so much has gotten one major league at bat. The Mariners offered him a 6-year contract to kind of buy up some of his future free agency. And Kevin Mather, on a Zoom call with a local Rotary club, all but admitted that it was the team's intention to send Kelenic back down to the minor league so that he would not accrue a year of service time, and thereby the Mariners would be able to keep him under team control for one additional year. But do we really need an admission to know that this is going on all over Major League Baseball? I know with some of the domestic violence cases, video really drives, you know, when you have videotape, it's irrefutable. But do you really need an admission that these players are being sent down for reasons that have nothing to do with the merits of whether they belong on the Major League Ball Club, that this is all about teams protecting their financial self-interest to the detriment of the player, and sending a player down in sort of a bad faith manner, violating the spirit of the collective bargaining agreement? So I think while Kevin Mather has resigned and we won't be hearing too much about him again, I think this episode exposes sort of the underbelly of service time manipulation. And it's a story that won't go away anytime soon because this is happening time and again throughout Major League Baseball.
So couple things, and you know, you hit on them. I think this, the story for those, Mappy, there's a transcript out there for anyone that wants to get into the nitty gritty. But, you know, on an executive level, it's just not a good look to go out and be speaking poorly of players, foreign national players, speaking poorly about players, English speaking skills. I think it's just not a good look, you know, for anyone that follows baseball. The international market is very competitive in terms of signing players. Players from Japan, players from the Dominican Republic. So it's just a really poor look, but just speaking ill of players that are not born in America, that, you know, that's it's a pain to hire interpreters, and you're, you know, surprised at their English speaking skills. So, and Dan, especially, we should touch upon it. I mean, the Mariners, when I grew up, I mean, they were really known, you know, they were the first club to take a chance on a Japanese import like Ichiro. I always thought of them as being really friendly to the international market.
They're friendly to great players. I mean, they had a chance. I mean, they've had Japanese ownership affiliation in the past, and I think there was a natural tendency to, you know, favor some Japanese born players. But Ichiro's talent spoke for itself. He could have been from Mars if he was a free agent from Mars with that talent. Every team in baseball would have been, you know, really happy to have him on their roster. So I think in Ichiro's case, it really is what was about a chance to get the best player in that particular league. But no, the Mariners, I don't know if this is unique to the Seattle Mariners. This is a problem, and this is an issue that almost every team in Major League Baseball, except for the Yankees, experiences, because the Yankees have been very vocal about the fact that they don't engage in this kind of service time manipulation. But this is a practice. This is like a de facto practice that is adopted by almost every team because they're trying to keep payroll down. They're trying to keep salaries down. It's bad enough that these players have to go through, several years of minor league baseball at sub minimum wages. Of course they get signing bonuses, but they play multiple years for basically peanuts in the minor leagues. And then the first couple of years, they have, team control over their rights for up to 6 years. And they spend so many years playing at a low wage under team control relative to the amount of time that they have where they can shop their wares to the highest bidder. This is not an accounting profession or a legal profession where you can apply your trade 30 or 40 years. These are exceptional players, people of exceptional talent, who can only professionally perform their services for maybe, best case scenario, 15 years. And for roughly two-thirds of that time, or a little less than two-thirds of their time, they're under total, control, and have their compensation artificially deflated.
I don't know. The Yankees, I'm sure it's prevalent across baseball. We can give the Padres credit for calling up Fernando Tatis early, but the truth is, I think it's, in terms of the legal takeaway, like, we are as a sport of baseball, right? And I think, I don't know who else is following it, but the sport itself, you lose a little bit less. So you have this draft that nobody really pays attention to because guys are caught in the minor leagues for 3-4 years. The bust rate on first round picks is higher than any other sport because we just don't see these guys. So be it injuries, be it development, there is an inherent problem with baseball that we don't see these stars for years. And then Dan, comments like these that, and again, like if there's no rules preventing it, like by all means, like it makes sense for teams to do it. It's just patently unfair to players. So, what we're talking about, and we kind of hit the Chris Bryant situation briefly, but you get 6 years of basically team control. The first three are going to be basically on some form of a minor, a minimum league contract, like whatever it is, 400, 500 grand. And then after year three, years 4, 5, and 6 are going to be paid on an arbitration scale. So a couple million dollars, but you're still basically under team control for the first 6 years. So teams don't want to start that arbitration clock until you're basically ready and you're almost going to be a guaranteed asset in that rookie, your rookie year. So I don't know. Like, I understand why teams are holding players back. I don't really think it's fair. But to your point, Dan, you mentioned it. If the Cubs were somehow won the grievance with Chris Bryant, like there's not going to be a grievance that a player is ever going to win because that was the most obvious example. Chris Bryant was, AAA list top prospect, and the Cubs were starting some scrub at third base. And like, why not call up Chris Bryant unless there's some other agenda? So I just want to kind of say this. I mean, like in the world that we're in, Dan, you mentioned like, saying something wrong on a Zoom call. You cannot, as the Seattle Mariners, have Kevin Mather out there as the president of your organization, basically, harming and hurting your interest and in the overseas market for signing, the domestic market in terms of the image of the team. So give the Mariners credit. We sometimes speak ill of teams' protocol and strategies. The Mariners got rid of him. He's going to say he resigned, but the Mariners and Mather parted ways basically within 24 hours of the story. So. It kind of nips it in the bud, so to speak. Obviously, the Mariners are going to take a hit, but it's damage control, PR, all the above. So give the Mariners a little bit of credit. Obviously, you made a mention of maybe not quality control in hiring, but they made the right decision, and I think they parted ways relatively quick.
Yeah, I mean, in his case, he's someone who Kevin Mather hasn't been in the limelight for the Mariners for his entire career. He was really a vice president of finance. Kind of worked his way up in the organization and didn't really have an out front role until 2015. So he'd been with the team for close to 20 years before anyone had ever heard of him. But there were already some red flags in his background. He's had a couple of, occasions where women sued the club over hostile work environment, and he was implicated in some of that stuff. And they kept promoting him. And when you have someone like that with those kinds of red flags that you keep promoting, it says something about the culture of the organization and the people doing the hiring just as much as it says something about the actual bad actors themselves. So, it's seemingly endemic throughout Major League Baseball to have, these hiring issues where you have problems that really worsen over time. And are reflective of a bad organizational culture.
So, you know, I think that's it's funny, Dan, as we're talking, I just got a notification from Bleacher Report that Jared Kelenic claims that he's being punished by the Mariners for not signing a long-term contract. So we're not hearing the end of this Mariner saga. There's definitely going to be more aspects to this. But Dan, let's put a pin in that for now. Let's move on to we'll move on to the NFL topic. Two topics that I wanted to get into that people had DM'd us about. The Xavien Howard situation with the Miami Dolphins and the ongoing, we'll say, Deshaun Watson situation in Houston. So, Dan, before I jump in, you're I guess a resident of Florida. Are you a fan of Xavien Howard's over for the Miami Dolphins?
Oh no, you should know, Dan, from all of our conversations, I'm loyal to True Blue. I've been a New York Giants fan since 1970, and despite being a transplanted New Yorker, I mean, I still follow and root for all the New York teams that I followed when I was living in New York, Knicks, Rangers, Giants, Yankees. I haven't been to a Dolphins game in my entire life. And I think I've watched only a couple of games in the 20 years I've lived here. So not a big follower of the Dolphins, except for when Bill Parcells ran the team back in 2008, 2009, and 2010. So for that 3-year period, I cared. Independent of that, not really.
Okay. So, I guess for those that don't know, and I think that will include Dan on this list, Xavien Howard is one of the top defensive players in the NFL. So if you don't know the name, it's a name that you should know. And then we have an interesting crossover with friend of the show, Darren Heitner, who was Xavien Howard's attorney for purposes of, we'll say, an inquiry, not a case that necessarily was involved. But I'm going to give you the brief facts. Allegedly, a lot of this because you guys are getting the gist. So on June 29th of 2020, there were shots fired into the home of NFL agent Demaryius Bilbo. And Demaryius Bilbo, no relation to Bilbo Baggins, but he was currently the agent of Xavien Howard at the time in June of 2020. So shots fired into this home, and his wife and his 12-year-old son were in the home at the time. So a scary event. Apparently, police spoke with the family. They thought they were fireworks going off until they saw a bullet hole had traveled from a window frame. They called the police. Police investigated. This is at 11:05 on June 29th. So scary situation when you find a bullet hole through your window. A little scary. So we get a lot of this information from an incident report that was released. But police allegedly spoke to Bilbo's son and basically said that he saw a 4-door golden sedan pull up to the front of the yard, and that he saw a black male in a gray hoodie walk onto the lawn. And then after Bilbo's son heard the bullet go into the home, this person, this black male in a gray hoodie, jumped back into the vehicle and immediately took off. So I guess the police looked at cameras, as they tend to do in the situation, and they found, at least according to reports, a Kia Optima that was registered to an individual named Angelica Thais Brown. Okay, so Dan, this is where it gets interesting. We're not going to know the full tie-in to this, but the incident report lists a number of names of people of interest, okay? And includes Angelica Thais Brown, some additional names. But the reason that this is a sports law story, Xavien Howard, who, again, at the time, was the client of Bilbo, is listed on this report. So we don't know exactly why he's connected to it, but he's listed on it. So if a bullet goes through a home and the client is connected to it, it's potentially a story. So it was an investigation that's been ongoing for the past couple months, but we don't exactly know what the involvement is. All we know, Dan, kind of from the outside, is Bilbo and Howard have since parted ways, I believe, in October. Howard fired Bilbo after this is notably a lucrative deal that Howard was able to sign. So, the update as of 2 days ago, this case is just kind of coming to light in the past, for us, past couple weeks, maybe past couple days, is that the case is now closed. Yeah, I don't believe there are any arrests made. I don't believe Howard is connected to it, but friend of the show, Darren Heitner, was retained as Howard's attorney and basically said this case is closed. The Dolphins have been aware of this incident for some period of time, and the case is closed. Dan, I know we were on the fence about including this topic, but as we know, Dan, from covering these, let's say Florida or Georgia, these sad cases in the South, criminal cases involving NFL players, they don't normally go away. So, Dan, let me turn it to you. Do you think It's the end of the story. Do you think there's going to be any ramifications here, you know, under the conduct detrimental policy, anything like that?
No, I mean, as we all know, there's no such thing as a closed case when no case had ever been brought. This was simply an investigation that so far hasn't yielded enough evidence to justify, you know, further proceedings or a grand jury or, you know, some kind of an indictment. But the absence of a parallel criminal investigation does not, as we learned in all these other NFL cases, particularly Antonio Brown, where he was sued in a civil charge. There was no police report, no criminal record. The NFL will conduct its own investigation if they believe that the allegations are, you know, not that they have merit, but that there's a good faith basis, you know, to move forward. And I think given how long this story has been out there, or maybe the NFL is just learning about it, I would imagine that the league would be conducting its own parallel investigation at a bare minimum, you know, submitting a public records request to get access to the police incident reports. And the closing, or at least the cessation for now of this investigation, may play into the NFL's hands, because now in a public records request, the police department or the agency won't be able to say, we can't give you these records because there's an active and ongoing investigation. By virtue of the current status of the case, I think the NFL can immediately get access to all the records and would be able to call in Howard for an interview and might even interview the agent. However, all that being said, I don't think this goes anywhere, because the only two people that have, you know, knowledge of the incident are two people who are very unlikely to cooperate, because the agent wants to continue representing NFL players. He's not going to throw his ex-player. I wouldn't even call that throwing him under the bus, but I don't think he's going to implicate a player in the National Football League of a criminal act, because he's still an active agent. I think, you know, in this case, literally no harm, no foul. I don't believe that the agent is going to want to make this into a criminal case or an NFL disciplinary proceeding. And without the agent's participation, and assuming Xavier Howard's silence and bare minimal cooperation, I don't see this having any legs where the NFL is going to levy discipline against Howard based upon what we know about the case so far. But it does, you know, what we've seen play out in other cases is that the NFL will look at this and they will try to gain access to the records and make their own independent determination without having it be influenced by, you know, any of the parallel criminal proceedings.
So just to clarify too, and I echo what you said, Dan, Howard was named as a person of interest. He was not a suspect. The case remains unsolved, but I guess with respect to Howard, he has been cleared. So, you know, again, we talk about this sometimes in the conduct, detrimental context, whatever it is. Being a person of interest in a shooting in your agent's house, and this bullet apparently pierced the child's playroom, it's just, I don't know, I would find it odd that the case is just going to go away. There's, you know, but Howard might have to answer questioning. I think some of the people named on the persons of interest also had some connections to Howard, whether they were known associates or whatnot. But, you know, you can believe what's out there. Again, just kind of a messy situation. And we, you know, this is what we do on conduct detrimental. We issue spot for you. We let you know things ahead of time. Because Dan and I, at this point, maybe we'll end up recording twice a week at some point, but we're once a week. So if there's a story that ends up breaking on Howard, you know, midweek, or maybe sometimes at 3 a.m, we just want you to have the backdrop of it. So Dan, you know, I think in the time we have left, I want to briefly move to the Deshaun Watson situation. For people that aren't following, you know, everyone knows our thoughts on the James Harden situation, but we have a brewing situation in the NFL. Just, we want to issue spot for people again. Deshaun Watson, star quarterback with the Houston Texans, has essentially demanded a trade. He's essentially shopping himself out. He's not talking to the Texans. The Texans aren't talking to other teams. So it's kind of a standoff. But again, we're kind of seeing this play out in the media. Player who was under contract in a long, lucrative extension that Watson signed, seemingly has leverage to force a trade, even though he's under contract. Dan, and I'm not going to put you in the spot, do you think there's any chance he goes to your New York Jets?
Well, he's going to go to somebody. I mean, if, you know, a player can't force a trade. the team ultimately has the leverage because if they don't want to trade him, he has no freedom of movement. But Deshaun Watson is doing everything in his power to make it difficult for Houston to keep them. And I think there's close to a 100% chance he gets traded. I don't know where he's going to end up, but I think if I'm the New York, the problem with any team trading for him is that the price tag that's been associated with trading for a player of that caliber is almost so cost prohibitive that, you know, you're talking like Sam Darnold, three number ones. I don't know if I do it if I'm the Jets. Are they close enough to winning where adding a Deshaun Watson puts them over the top? I don't know who the right team is, but clearly by the beginning of the NFL season in September, he's going to be on another roster because by this point, I think so. There's been so much that's gone on, and it's past the point of no return. I don't think this is a salvageable relationship.
Yeah, we shall see. I think from a leverage standpoint, the Texans are saying that he's not tradable, but somehow we have reports that exactly, you know, the specifics that would require to get him. I think it's 3 first-round picks and 2 defensive starters. So somehow, even though they're not entertaining trading him, we have reports as to what would be required to obtain him. So some mixed signals going on over with the Texans, which par for the course with the Houston Texans mismanagement in the last 365 days. So that being said, Dan, I think we can put this one in the books. Anything else to add?
No, not at all. I think it was a fun episode, and looking forward to seeing how some of these stories develop, because obviously Deshaun Watson, it's a story to be continued. Artemi Panarin, the final chapters haven't been written, but they've been a couple of interesting detours on our sports law travels for this week.
Okay, so as always, you can find Dan Wallach on social media at Wallach Legal, myself, Dan Lust, at Sports Law Lust. The show is Conduct Detrimental. Quick shout out to our TikTok account, which has been relatively blowing up. Credit to Taryn Sharma and recent addition to the Conduct Detrimental family, Stephanie Weisenberger. Definitely check them out over there. And with that being said, we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.